morning, sir.
Oh, good morning.
And for the record, just hold one second. Let me wait till everybody gets in the room. Just one second. I'll be right with you, sir.
Yes, sir.
Sir, you appear before the Arizona Board of Executive Committee. May I get you to state your name and ABC number for the record at this time, sir?
Yes, sir. David Michael Cook, number 109489.
Thank you, Mr. Cook. Mr. Cook, you appear before the Arizona Board of Executive Committee inasmuch as you have been certified by the Department of Corrections for a 412 being or 411 hearing today. 412 being means that you're being considered to be paroled to your next consecutive sentence, or 411 for absolute discharge. According to information that I see coming to us from the Department of Correction, you're currently serving a sentence for murder in the first degree, and this sentence had its beginning back on September 5, 1993. You will become parole eligible on September 5, 2018, which means whatever action we take today, if we want to move to your next consecutive sentence, it would not become effective until September 5 of this year. And is that your understanding, sir?
Yes, sir.
And that if this board saw fit to move to your consecutive sentence, then the sentence would be kidnapping. And that would be a 21-year sentence. And then if you move there, then you would have one more sentence, and that would be for sexual assault, and that is a 15-year sentence. Is that also correct, sir?
Yes, sir.
But before going further, let me introduce you to the board, because you cannot see us today because we're doing this by telephone. And we have five board members present, which is all of the board members. We have the Honorable Mr. Michael Johnson, the Honorable Ms. Sylvia Rittenhouse, the Honorable Mr. David Neal, the Honorable Mr. Louis Kiwanis, and my name is C.T. Wright. I'm board chair and serving as your panel chair this morning, sir. I would also take note, sir, that you do have your attorney present along with some supporters. And so what we will do, for this hearing, we're going to begin by receiving, I'm going to make a further general statement. Then we will ask if you or would you want your attorney to speak first. Then once that would happen, then we have supporters in the room. Then we would have testimony coming from your supporters. Once that is completed, then we will go to the victim side of the house. Then we will have testimony coming from the victims and others representing the victims. That will be followed by, once that has happened, we will come back to you for a final statement from you. Then the board will go into discussion and will make a decision at that point whether to move you to your next consecutive sentence or absolute discharge. Do you understand, sir?
Yes, sir, I do.
Okay, so at this time, I'm going to just make just a very brief statement, and then we will be ready to either hear from you or from your attorney whether you would like to speak first, because this is your hearing. You will make that determination. I will not make that determination. You will make that determination whether you or your attorney will be speaking first on your behalf, sir. I will take note, sir, that we do have a copy of your institution progress report that was submitted to the board. And it seems to me that you have had only one recent program, and that would be sexual offense. And that seems to me that that's taken place just last year, November to December of 2017. Is that the last program that you've had, or counseling that you've had, sir?
Yes, sir,
SOETP. Yes, sir, SOETP. And were you taking the beginning part of that program, or whether this is an ongoing program? When, what were you This is your first time being taken in the SOETP program, sir?
It is my first time. I'm in the beginning phase of it now. I'll try to graduate this month, and we'll move on to the next part.
Okay. Well, thanks so much for calling that to the attention of the board. I do not show any other recent programming. Have you had any other programming since, I guess, 08? Have you had any other programming since 08, sir?
Just AA and NA, sir.
Okay. And are you still taking any AA or NA at this time, sir?
No, sir. I work and I go to the SOETP on it.
Okay, sir. And what kind of work are you doing, sir?
I work at ACI. I worked there for the last 8 years.
Okay.
Yes, sir.
Go ahead, sir. This is your hearing. So is that work helpful to you? You're getting a skill, or you think you labor? What are you doing there, sir?
I do automotive upholstery. I'm the lead man in my department.
Okay. Well, we commend you for that, because it's always good to be busy and doing something productive. We show your release plan. We show that what was included on your record. Here it's parole to consecutive sentence, and that is correct, because you're not going to be released today at any rate, because you will be paroled to your next consecutive sentence, which I believe, again, is a 21-year sentence, so it was not necessary. Take note that you did have a couple of disciplines in 2016. You had one, but it was informally resolved, a violation of departmental issues there. And you also had one in 15, and that was promoting a prison contraband, and that one was dismissed. Are those the last two disciplines that you had, sir?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
And before then, what was the last one that you had before those, because they were either dismissed or informally resolved?
I think the last one I had was 2005.
Okay. So why did you, I know this was resolved, so what happened that recently 15 and 16 that you ended up, although they were, this one was dismissed, the other one was informally resolved, what happened? Did something happen, or you just happened to have been in the wrong place at the wrong time? What was going on, sir?
In 2015, four of a share of toolbox and one guy had a pair of sunglasses and an alarm clock in it. So they wrote us up for contraband, and he told them that it was his, so they dismissed it on me. And in 2016, I had on a thermal shirt underneath the t-shirt, and the officer said I couldn't do that, so he wrote me a ticket.
Okay, sir. And just for the record, because I'm not to be clear, and you didn't call it to my attention, but I do take note that the third sentence, the one for 15 years, sexual assault, that is attempt to commit. So I just want to put that on the record just so that we would be clear on that one, sir. I would also just point out, according to information that I've gleaned, that this is your first time appearing for the Arizona Board of Executive Clemency. Am I correct, sir?
Yes, sir.
And so since this is your first time, we really want the board to become acquainted with you and with the crime that was committed that got you incarcerated in the first place for murder in the first degree, as well as the other two. So I think rather than my trying to explain what happened, I would want you to tell us what happened, or your attorney to tell us what happened. Why did you end up being incarcerated, receiving a 21-year sentence, and what happened that resulted in this crime, sir? So you want to tell us, or do you want your attorney to come forward at this time, sir?
I'll tell you what happened, sir.
Okay, well, please tell the board what happened, and the board will be listening, and then after you tell us, then the board will ask questions if the board sees fit, sir. So please go ahead, sir.
All right. In September of 1993, I was outside my apartment drinking beer with a couple of my friends when my co-defendant, Craig Flanders, walked up with the lady he had just met. Her name was Bernadette Morey. After talking a while, we went over to Craig's apartment, and we weren't there long when Miss Morris said that she needed to use the restroom. And while she was going, Craig said, let's knock her out and have sex with her. And I agreed to do that. When she came out of the bathroom, I hit her and knocked her down and kicked at her. And he jumped on her. And when she screamed, and I knew right then that I had done wrong, and I grabbed the other guy who was with me, and we left the apartment. But it was my actions that put her there. It was, and I said it was me that agreed to do it.
Now you said you hit her, sir. What did you hit her with, sir?
I had the head of a hammer in my hand, and I hit her. I knocked her down and kicked at her and kicked her.
So you actually hit her with the hammer, sir?
It was wrapped up in the palm of my hand, so yes, sir, I hit her with it.
Okay, sir. And did you also instruct your co-defendant to cut her throat and all of that, or is that information correct, sir?
That was when we were leaving, and no, sir, that was the guy who was with me, but it was me there, and I didn't say it, but I was right there, and I agreed. I didn't tell him not to. I didn't try to help her or nothing. It was me.
So were you there? I mean, you said that your co-defendant or the person who was there, that y'all were there together. What was the purpose of y'all being there with her? Were you planning to rape her? Why were you there, sir, with her?
We were drinking and just... It ended up in his apartment, and that's when Craig Planis come up with the idea, and I agreed to it.
So where did you meet her? Where did y'all meet her at, sir? How did you end up?
He had met her at a bar and brought her back to his apartment. He was my neighbor. I had never met her. None of us had. She was a stranger to us.
So I know it was a long time ago, but why would you... Your recollection, why would you actually hit her with a hammer, sir? I mean, there are two males in there, and why didn't you, I mean, and I would still condemn it, but why didn't you just hit her with your hand? Why would you hit her with a hammer and then have the other gentleman there to cut her and all that? Why would y'all so physical with her, sir? Your recollection, sir.
Sir, there's no excuses or reasons for why I did what I did. At the time, I just got out of the Marines, and my wife had left me, and my life was just in a turmoil. I was angry and depressed and being just very selfish, not thinking of anybody but myself. And I made horrible decisions that night.
What were you angry about, sir?
Like I said, my wife had left me. I was living paycheck to paycheck, and I needed help and didn't even realize that I needed help. I just made horrible decisions and a lot of bad choices.
You mentioned that you had just gotten out of the U.S. Marine Corps. When you came out of the Marine Corps, what type of discharge did you get, sir?
I got a bad conduct discharge, sir.
And for those of us who have not been in the military, what does that mean, sir? A bad discharge, sir. Well, what was that about, sir?
I had gotten in trouble for taking a camcorder, so I got a bad conduct in.
And were you any action taken against you, or they just discharged you, sir? What happened with the Marines?
I spent 5 months in the brig, and then I was discharged.
And then after you were discharged, that's when you came back and committed this offense, sir. Am I correct or am I not correct, sir?
No, you're correct, sir.
Now, with your situation with the Marines and you're out, did you have... Now that you reflect on, did you have some anger management challenges? I know you had the problem with your wife, you know, and got divorced and all of that separation. But something must have been going on in your mind at that time, sir. So what was going on? Can you tell the board What was really going on in your mind at that time, sir?
I was angry at everybody. I hated myself. I wanted to blame everybody for what was going on in my life when it was my fault, not anyone else's. I was drinking and doing drugs and just, like I said, I made horrible decisions. I really needed some help, and I didn't realize it at the time, and neither did my family. But yes, sir, I needed help, and I made horrible decisions that night.
Sir, speaking of your family, what type of family did you have at that time, sir?
I had an uncle who lived in Tucson, and everyone else was living in Texas. That's all I had out here was an uncle. And I didn't turn to him when I should have.
So have you had any contact with your uncle during that period, or that was something that was just... did you have a relationship with your uncle, I guess is what I'm trying to get at, sir.
Oh, yes, sir. He was living with us for a time. He had an operation. Mm-hmm. And he had just moved out of my apartment into his own place. But yes, sir, we talked to one another once or twice a week.
And it's my understanding that your wife, I guess the one that you're separated from, you had two kids, am I correct, sir?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir, a boy and a girl.
And they moved to Texas, am I correct, sir?
Yes, sir. They had left in August, and I had done this in September.
Okay. So they left in August, and you did this in September. Okay, so why do you think the... Yeah, as you reflect now, why do you think that your wife left with the kids, sir?
Because I was angry all the time. I could barely support them. I was working a job that was just a little over minimum wage, and she just didn't like me anymore. And I don't blame her for that.
You said you had a job a little more than minimum wage. What were you doing? What were you employed? What were you doing, sir, in terms of employment?
I was a mechanic at U-Haul.
And you had not thought of any way to get your life together, so you were just taking it out on yourself and anybody else during that period, sir?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. That's what I was doing.
So maybe you want me to answer this when you're on drugs or were you on alcohol? What was going on around drugs, alcohol, sir?
I was drinking every day. I was smoking marijuana, doing harder drugs like methamphetamines. I was just doing as much wrong as I could, it seems like.
My next question, we'll get back to this later, but I'm going ahead and ask it now, sir. After all these years, what have you done to improve yourself, to say, I mean, at that time you were angry with yourself, you were angry with everybody else, so are you still angry with everybody else? What are you now, sir, in terms of psychologically in your mind, sir?
I believe now I'm doing really well. I have taken every class that DOC offers, and most of them multiple times. Right now, I am in a SOETP. I volunteered for that class. It's really helped me to recognize what my red flags are. Anger and depression and blaming other people and drugs and alcohol too. And I've also talked to my parents. You know, they're like my support network and explain what those red flags are. And they help hold me accountable. When I call home, my mom can tell just by my voice that I've had a bad day and wants to know what's going on right away. I feel like I'm in a good place right now.
How often do you call home, sir?
About every other day.
That's good. Speaking of I'm still not quite clear what you could really say that has changed in your life. You speak of the SOETP Have you identified any triggers? I know you said your anger management and so forth. Have you identified any triggers that forced, that resulted in your behavior when this offense was committed, sir?
Yes, sir, I have. It's, again, anger, blaming other people, being depressed is really something I have to pay attention to, and drugs and alcohol. That I also go to church every week. I pray every day. I have gotten my life together.
Okay, sir. At this time, I'm going to see if other board members might have some questions, and then we'll go to your lawyer or your supporter. But I'm going to see if board members might have any questions at this time. They will have an opportunity all morning to raise questions with you, sir, but I want to check at this time. Questions. Honorable Mr. Johnson.
Sir, you said earlier that when this incident occurred that you were just in a state of mind that you needed help. Is that right?
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear you, sir.
You said earlier that when this incident occurred that you were in a state of mind that you needed help.
When this incident occurred, I was in a state of mind of...
That you needed help.
I did need some help, sir. Okay. I didn't even realize it at the time, but I did. I needed some guidance, and I didn't even know to ask for it. But I wish I had.
So you said you're taking some programming now, and you know what your triggers are, and you reached out to get some help?
Yes, sir. I take the programming. I go twice a week with a therapist. And I do realize what's going on in my life, and know right away when I'm in a bad spot to go talk to some people.
So, do you know at the time that this incident occurred, so why was it so brutal and violent?
I'm sorry again, sir, but I couldn't understand you.
When the incident occurred at that time, why was it so brutal and violent?
Sir, again, there's no excuse or reason for what I've done. It's I made horrible decisions, and there's just no excuse for it. I don't know why it was so brutal. It was just a horrible, horrible thing that happened.
So can you explain what it is and what has changed where you would not make any decisions like that again?
I apologize again, sir, but I couldn't understand what you said.
Can you explain what has changed in your life that you would not make such a decision like that again?
Like I stated earlier, I have taken every class that DOC offers. I realized what was happening then, and I understand how I am now. I understand what causes me to be angry, what causes me to be so selfish, and I have understood how to get help for those issues.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Cook.
Thank you, Honorable Mr. Johnson. Another question, Honorable Mr. Colonis has questions for you, sir.
Thank you, Honorable Dr. Wright. Mr. Cook, can you hear me?
Yes, sir, I can.
I'm not sure if you answered this question, so bear with me, but I'm trying to figure out why there was so much anger in you at that time. I understand your marriage had fallen apart, and I recognize the sort of cycle of depression people go through when those tragedies happen, but we've talked about triggers, and why do you think now, upon reflection, you were so angry at that time?
Well, I just lost everything that I wanted in the Marines, and then my wife left. I felt like everybody was against me, and that wasn't true, but that's how I felt, that I was completely by myself, and that no one cared, and I blamed everyone else for what was going on in my life, and the truth is I hated myself, and that was reflected upon everyone else. I was being very selfish, and blaming everyone for what was happening to me, when it was really me that was the problem.
I guess I'm just having trouble trying to understand how that translated into murdering and raping an individual. And I have a real specific question, and that is, and I'm sorry to be cold and clinical, but where did the framing hammer come from? How did you come into possession of that?
Craig Planich had it. I think it was on the counter or on top of the refrigerator. And when he said, "Let's knock her out and have sex with her," I agreed to do it, and he handed it to me. And that's what I hit her with.
What was your career in the Marine Corps?
I was a metal smith on Hueys and Cobras.
And you had said things had not worked out for you in the Marine Corps, and we saw the short statement on you getting in trouble over the camcorder, but what was going on with you in the Marine Corps that led to that bad decision?
Are you asking why I took the camcorder when I was in the Marines?
Yes, it would seem that you had a lot at stake in maintaining your good standing in the Marine Corps. It sounded like you wanted to be a Marine.
I did, and we were unloading boxes that had come back from overseas, and my wife had been wanting one, and there was one sitting there, and I took it. It was just a very bad decision again.
There was a reference in the pre-sentencing report to you getting into an assault with an officer. Was that true?
No, sir, I didn't have anything like that, getting into a fight with an officer. No, sir.
Did you have any other incidents in the military that were related to anger or outbursts or assault? Or?
No, sir, nothing like that. I drank all the time, but I never got in any fights or anything.
Thank you, sir. I'm over the questions, Doc.
Thank you so much, Dr. Mr. Kalanis. Any further questions at this time? I don't see any further questions by board members at this time. If it's okay with you, Mr. Cook, I will ask your lawyer to come forward and he will guide us the direction that we want to go in terms of whether he wants to say something first or whether he wants some of your supporters to speak. So I'm just going to turn it over to you, sir. Please begin by stating your name for the record, sir.
Yes, thank you. Honorable members of the board, my name is David Lee Partito.
Thank you, and welcome to the board, sir.
Thank you. I've been Mr. Cook's lawyer handling his clemency petition, or his petition for commutation, which was submitted a few months ago. And I know the board isn't considering that today, as obviously it's very new. But I'd like to cite some sections of it, and if it's available to the board, it might be worth reading some of the narrative sections that do describe in somewhat more detail, and I will try to do that now, some of the questions the board has been asking. First, I'd like to point out that we do have several other family members here, one of whom is going to speak, Fred Shepard, who is Mr. Cook's stepfather, and really his father for all practical purposes, has been supportive of him throughout this ordeal. He is here and he will speak. He has also provided me with a letter that I've made copies of. If I could, I'd like to hand it to the board.
Yeah, sure.
I think I have 5 copies total of it.
Okay, well, thank you so very much, sir.
Thank you. The other people here are his mother, Medina Shepherd, who's sitting next to Mr. Shepherd, and his son, David Jr. David Jr. Has a number of medical and developmental issues. He is not able to speak. He does not hear. but because they didn't have a caregiver for him, they brought him today. His condition is one of the factors considered that's brought up in the petition for commutation. However, I don't know that it's relevant to talk too much about that today, since there's no possibility of release, and it's simply a 412B matter. I do want to discuss a little bit and try to address some of the questions asked by the board. David did a good job, but I've met with him on four occasions now and gotten to know him pretty well. And he did talk to me quite a bit about some of these same issues, including how he got involved in this offense and what his thinking was at the time. He was 22 years old, but it was clear that he was a very young and immature 22. He was a person who had gone through his younger life without problems, who had always wanted to have a military career, had joined the Marines, had gotten involved in a great deal of substance abuse, even in the Marines, and that had essentially wrecked his military career. That was something that was very upsetting to him. As he tells you now, he's a very different person now than he was then, not just older, but far more mature and insightful. And so, as he told you, that was a great distress to him, and he blamed everybody but the person he should have blamed, which was himself. He did get a bad conduct discharge, which is not as bad as a dishonorable one, but still not a very good thing to have. He not only was out of the Marines, but he was out in a way that was not, in his mind, a very good thing, and not in most people's mind. And then he continued his substance abuse. He had a job that was probably below what he had ever expected to do. He was having severe problems at home, and it wasn't just that his wife had left him. And as he says, he doesn't blame her at all for doing that. It's probably the right thing for her to do. But when she left him, she took their two young children with them. He was convinced that that was the end of his family life, that he was not going to see them. His parents were living in another state. He wasn't having a relationship with Mr. Rapp, who would have been the perfect person to have guided him at that time. There's a letter in the packet that David submitted from Bruce Rapp. He was his uncle, but he was also a Federal Bureau of Protections officer. He would have been a perfect person to have talked to. David didn't turn to him. Another mistake. Instead, he turned increasingly to drugs and alcohol, and obviously people he should not have been hanging out with. What happened that evening, and this is from David's narrative, was that he was with a man who worked with Chris McKenzie and another friend. They were drinking heavily. After a while, the friend leaves, and with two other men, David and Chris wind up at the apartment of the neighbor, Craig Plantage. David will never deny his active involvement in this terrible crime. He takes full responsibility for it. But I think it's important, as his attorney, for me to point out that he was not the prime mover of the crime. Craig was. Craig was the person who knew Bernadette, who had brought Bernadette to the apartment, and who formed the intention of committing this crime. David went along with it, and that was absolutely wrong. But Craig was the prime mover. Craig was the man who suggested it. He was the man who handed David the weapon. And he was the one who, once David hit Bernadette, jumped on top of her and committed the sexual assault. I think it's important to note a couple of things. One is that David did not himself commit a sexual assault, but he essentially abandoned the crime in the middle and left, and was not the person who struck the fatal blow. That, again, was Craig using a knife after David had left. None of this excuses David. He also abandoned Bernadette. What he knew even then, in his immaturity and his intoxication, that he should have done was intervene on her behalf. He didn't, and he feels, frankly, as bad about that as anything else he did or didn't do that evening. So what is the difference between David then and David now, besides the classes he's taken, besides his maturity? And he and I spent a great deal of time talking about this, and I believe that the difference is that he did not know or understand what empathy meant. I make a distinction between remorse and empathy. This board, I'm sure, hears a great deal about remorse. And there's always the question of, are you remorseful because of what you did, or are you remorseful that you got caught and you went to prison and your life was ruined? And that was a distinction that David was not able to make. He was not psychologically capable. His brain wouldn't wrap around that concept. It took him years in prison, and the classes certainly helped, but other things helped too, to learn empathy, to learn to give regard to the feelings and the rights and the life of other people. And that's the difference between David then and now. He spoke to me quite sincerely about Bernadette. He talked about how he thought about her every day, how he thought about how she could have become a mother and a grandmother. He thought about his own son, and the fact that his son, despite his son's great needs, David was not there to serve those needs. He thought about what that meant for the victim and her family and her being taken away. And over time, and once he had gotten his substance abuse problem under control, because that blunted his ability to feel empathy, once he gotten that under control, and over time, he learned and was able to speak quite articulately about the victim in this case and about her family. And that is the major difference between David then and now. He's demonstrated that difference in a number of different ways. Yes, he has taken every program that's been available to him. And when this sex offender program became available, he signed up for that. That was not my idea, that was his. He brought it to my attention, and I said, of course, that's something you could do. He also has worked consistently perhaps 10 different jobs, all of them successful in prison. He's also done some things that don't appear in the record, and that's that he's counseled other younger inmates. The way he explained this to me was very interesting. He said, because I had been convicted of first-degree murder, I had this weird kind of street cred. People would come to me and say, you're a murderer. Wow, you must be a big man. He said it made him feel very strange, very weird. But he said, I learned that I could use that street cred. And so he talked to younger inmates. I don't know, I didn't see it, if their letters were included in the packet that he submitted, but they were included in the commutation petition. And these were young men who had felt that David had done them a great deal of good in prison. And it was obvious to me that David has gained a certain amount of regard. We could not submit letters from DOC members, but it was obvious to me that they had some regard for David. He has had a very good disciplinary record. The two incidents that the board mentioned, both of them resolved or dismissed, were minor. And were essentially the only things he has had in the last 15 years. He had no major incidents and nothing that I think that was upheld at all. So he's been a model inmate in that regard as well. I don't see if there's anything else from his petition that would be relevant to today. I talked about the empathy, talked about what he's done to make amends. You've seen this corrections plan. I could tell you more about what he would do if he were released, but again, I don't think that's directly relevant. He does have this tremendous family support and family needs. That what you're looking at with David is a person who is a good person who did a very evil thing. That on one day of his life, because he was extremely intoxicated, extremely angry, because he had no insight into himself, and he was with the wrong person, a person who actually instigated the crime, he committed a terrible crime. It's something that he's had to live with, his family has had to live with, the victim's family has had to live with. And it's something that haunts him and will always haunt him. He's done, I think, what he can do to make himself into a different person, to make what amends he can. So I'd ask that you do what the board can do at this point, which is parole him to his next consecutive offense. And with that, of course, if the board has any questions of me, I'd be glad to try to answer them as his attorney. Otherwise, I would turn it over to Fred Shepard, who also has a statement to make.
I'll just make the statement, sir, just for the record, that we do have letters from his mother, from his stepfather, from the federal law enforcement officer, from his uncle, and from inmates, among others. I did just want to put that on record. We do have those. They are part of his package, as well as 10 or more certificates that he has in his records, sir.
Thank you, sir.
This letter that is to his
daughter. And the letter, yes, sir, that you presented to the board a few moments ago, sir. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Please come forward, sir. Would you state your name for the record, sir?
Yes, thank you. My name is Fred Shepard.
Welcome to the board, sir.
I'm David's stepdad, and I just wanted to say that, you know, I believe that, you know, growing up, Dave had a lot of alcoholic influence in his life, and I think he just, at that age, that was how he handled his problems, was drinking. And I understand that, and I had years of drinking in my young life. It's been over 30 years since I've had a drink, and I'm sure that Dave is in the same position of understanding the damage that, you know, really this was one night of drinking that led to 25 years that he's been up there. And, you know, I just am confident that there will never be a time to drink that's in his lips. He's just, that life is behind him. He doesn't want any part of it. And he doesn't resemble the person that committed that crime, for sure. You know, being up in prison, he's worked the whole time. He's always had a good work ethic. In high school, he worked 2 or 3 jobs, and he was in the Marines and wanted to be a career soldier. So he's always worked hard, and whenever he's able to come home, I know he will continue to work. It's just who he is. You know, I feel like he's done everything he could do to put himself in the best position. He's worked the whole time he's been there. He's participated in every program. And like his lawyer said, he's been there as a mentor to the younger guys up there. He really has never been in any trouble since he's been there. As far as, you know, our needs for him, I mean, we need him to be home. His mom has been dealing with lupus for 25 years. She's been going up there visiting him and taking phone calls several times a week the whole time and been right there for him, but it's very hard for her. And we've been taking care of his son for over 15 years, who is sitting here in the courtroom, and he's deaf, he's got some disability, a lot of cognitive issues that came from a fever that caused the deafness, I believe. But he went to school at ASDB, and he's been working with the Beacon Foundation, and we've been taking care of him for over 15 years, but he's had a really good relationship with his dad. He visits him often, and they have a strong bond, and he really needs him. In the last year, he's developed a serious heart condition. It had actually developed years before, but it never showed up until last February. He's had a couple surgeries already. They're talking about going in and carving obstruction out of the middle of his heart, which is very serious and really scary. So I just want to say that, you know, from my perspective, I mean, we need him home more than ever, and I am positive that society doesn't need to be protected from him. His record in prison will show that, you know, he was going to be in trouble again. He certainly would have during that time. Nobody spends that much time in prison without being in trouble. So I'm just 100% behind him being paroled. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. May I just ask this? How long have you been in his life, sir? I believe you're the stepfather.
Yeah, and I had a son who had gotten in some trouble when he was in high school and was in the county jail. And I met Dave's mom when we were visiting there. And we got married that year, and I've been visiting Dave ever since. And been in his life for the last 25 years, but he was in the county jail when I met him. But he's a great guy. He's not the person that you would see by looking at what happened that night at all. It's just a great guy, as good a decent person as I've ever known. I stand behind him completely.
Thank you, sir. And I'm still, other board members, may I have any questions for you, sir? I don't see any questions from other board members. Thank you so very much for coming today. Thank you, sir. Once again, is there anyone else who wishes to speak on behalf of support of Mr. Cook? Yes, ma'am. Please come forward. Good morning. Would you state your name for the record, please, ma'am?
My name is Shepherd.
Thank you so very much. And what would you like to tell the board, Ms. Shepherd?
I'm Dave's mom, and I had Dave from grade when I was 17. He didn't have the best childhood. I raised him myself. My family are alcoholics. We all know that. That's what's the way of life. I've never drank myself, but they all did. The night this all happened, I called Dave at work and told him to call me right away because his son had nearly gotten run over by a car. His mom wasn't watching him. He's deaf. He didn't hear the car. I was crying and hysterical. I got Dave all upset. And he was planning to come home to Texas the very next day. The reason he was so upset was because of his son. He loves that kid. He loves both of his kids. But him and David Jr. are very, very close. And that's all I want to say, except he's the best son anybody could ever have. And that holds no weight to what he did that night. It was all, it was just unthinkable. And I'm so sorry for Bernadette and her family, as he is. It haunts me every day of my life, but we can't change it. And I just wanted you to know that he is the best son. That's all I have to say.
Thank you so very much, Mrs. Shepherd. Any questions for Mrs. Shepherd? I see no questions. Thanks so much for coming today. Anyone else wishes to speak on behalf of Mr. Cook? Anyone else? Anyone else? Okay, thank you. Now, this time we will go to the victim side, and note that we have attorneys present, so we usually yield to the attorneys and ask you to bring up others in the order that you would see fit.
Thank you, Mr. Good morning, Mr. Chairman, honorable members of the board. My name is Julia Elder Valenti. I am an attorney with Arizona Voice for Crime Victims. I represent Mr. Gary Mori. He is the husband of murdered victim Bernadette Mori. For the record, he is present in the courtroom today, behind me, sitting in the first row. He has support with him, as well as somebody from our office as an advocate to be with him today. And notably, as you are well aware, his wife, Bernadette Mori, died as a result of the heinous actions of inmate David Michael Cook and his co-worker. I'm sure you are very well aware of the tragic facts of the case at this point. What I would like to do is to highlight some of the more important facts of the case later. However, first, Mr. Gary Mori has written a victim impact statement. He is, unfortunately, due to the trauma that has been brought up by this hearing, again, of the murder of his wife, he's unable to read it to the board himself. Therefore, our advocate, Mary Wallace, will be reading that for him. She is also with Arizona Voice for Crime Victims. And she will read a letter about how Mr. Mori's life was impacted by inmate Cook brutally murdering his wife and the mother of his child. I will then come back up after Mr. Mori's letter is read. At that point, I'd like to present to you the laws in effect at the time of the sentencing of this case. The sentencing that was imposed by Judge Leonardo, I'd like to discuss with you at that point the clear intent of Judge Leonardo to do everything within his power of that sentencing scheme and structure to ensure that this inmate remain in prison for practically the rest of his life. We believe that this is particularly important because as many of these crimes happening decades ago, it is difficult to know what the judge was thinking at the time. However, this in this particular case, it is very clear what his intent was through his sentencing scheme and his very detailed minute entry at sentencing. At the very end, I will ask you to honor the judge's intent, the victim's family's wishes, the interests of society and justice by firmly denying inmate Cook the relief that he's seeking today. So at this time, Mr. Mori's letter will be read to the board.
Thank you, ma'am.
Good morning. I'm Mary with Arizona Voice for Client Victims, and I have some pictures I'd like to share as well as a collage. May I approach?
Yes, ma'am. If you do know these will be in the record, they will not be returning to you.
I do know that.
Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you.
I also have a collage that I'd like to share with you. So would you like me to show it to you now?
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you.
If I hand it to you, will you?
Yes,
okay.
Thank you.
This collage was at the funeral, placed right next to the casket for Bernadette that day. I'd like to read a statement prepared by Gary Mori. My name is Gary Mori. My wife, Bernadette, was brutally murdered by the inmate and his friends on September 5th, 1993. I would like to tell you why this inmate should be denied parole today and remain in prison for the rest of his life. But first, I'd like to tell you about my wife and how her loss continues to affect our daughter and myself to this day. My wife's name was Bernadette, but to her friends and family, she was known as Bernie. I met Bernie one night when I was with friends at a bar owned by my aunt on Speedway in Tucson. I was sitting at a table and she walked by. I normally kept to myself, but there was something special about the pretty, light brown-haired girl that walked by. She had such a happy smile and something just struck me about her. I asked her where she was going and wouldn't she rather want to sit down at my table for a while. I was so happy that she did. We talked and laughed, and it took no time at all to fall in love with Bernie. She was happy and full of life. We just fit together. We were married in 1981, and our daughter was born in 1989. Bernie was murdered right before our 12th wedding anniversary. Stephanie, our daughter, was only 4 years old. Bernie worked as a waitress at several restaurants in Tucson. She was what you would describe as a people person. Bernie was always happy, full of life, and loved talking to people. It was not unusual for her to know the names of everyone at the tables and what their favorite drink was. This was just the type of person Bernie was. On the night Bernie was murdered, she had just returned from a trip to Minnesota to visit her family. She wanted to go out and spend some time with her girlfriends, bar hopping together. They all took a cab instead of driving. I am sure Bernie was her usual self that night, happy and full of life, talking to people she met and enjoying herself. I know this because she was that way the night I met her. This was the Bernie that I knew and loved. At some point in the evening, she lost track of her girlfriends. Somehow, they left without her in the cab. Bernie must not have had the money to call a cab for herself, and I don't know why she didn't call me or someone to come pick her up. Instead, Bernie struck up a conversation with Plantage, who offered her a ride home. I am sure she was her usual friendly, outgoing self and had no reason to suspect what was going to happen to her. When they came the next morning to tell me that she had been killed, I just went numb. Stephanie was only 4 years old at the time, too young to understand what had happened to her mother. I attended all the trials and hearings for the three men responsible for the murder of my wife. I heard the horrific details of what they did to Bernie. I learned that my wife was horribly tortured before she died. I know she suffered and was probably very scared. I heard the details of how Bernie tried to get away from his men, money with her clothes torn off. I heard evidence that inmate Cook saw Plantage attacking and throwing rocks at Bernie as she lay in the gravel, and all he could say was, "Hurry up and kill her before the police can get here." I heard about the sounds my wife made as the knife severed her spinal cord. Because of this murder, I was left to raise my daughter by myself. She grew up without a mother. I did the very best I could, but it was a struggle. Stephanie deserved to have her mother there for all the times a little girl just needs her mom. I'm proud of the young woman she's become. She is headstrong and determined. I'm sure her life would have been very different if she'd grown up with the support and love of her mother. Stephanie knows the hearing is happening today, but she is not able to be here. It's just too difficult for her. I've struggled to prepare the statement for you today. I've been forced to relive the horrible murder of my wife. The details of the brutality of her murder have all come back. This is opening the wounds that have begun to heal. Now I must stand before this board today and once again relive the memories and ask you to deny release of inmate Cook. This inmate should never be released to the community. No family should ever have to go through this. He took advantage of Bernie's happy, trusting smile that night. He took part in brutally torturing and murdering my wife. I ask this board to respectfully deny parole to this inmate. He should never have been given the opportunity to take away the smile or rob someone of their life as he did. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
And I neglected to state my co-counsel, Eric Aiken, also with Arizona Voice for Crime Victims, is present. He will be holding up the collage of victim Bernadette Murray for us during this presentation. I'd like to inquire from the board briefly, were you able to receive letters from a Bruce and Becky? Becky is the victim's sister, and Bruce is the brother-in-law of Mr. Gary Murray. Unfortunately, it appears that those letters did not make their way to the board in time for this hearing. I would like to note that they did prepare statements and had intended to send them. It looks like somehow it got lost in the mix. Given that their statements were not presented, I'd just like to briefly bring up the statements that Bernadette had two sisters, so I'm unclear whether it was Becky or another sister who made these statements. But in the pre-sentence report, one of the sisters in a letter noted the following. She described Bernadette as a wonderful person who was full of life and loved life. She wanted to go on living forever because she loved life and wanted to live it to the fullest. Yet, she was deprived of the chance to even spend one more month with a multitude of family and friends who loved her. Her death has left a giant hole in many souls. She missed her sister's wedding. She will miss the birth of her nephew. She missed her niece's graduation. She missed her daughter's first loose tooth and will miss seeing her daughter grow up, graduate, and get married. She will never see her grandchildren. She implores this sister implores the court to reflect on the people she left behind, a husband, a four-year-old daughter, two sisters who loved her immensely, a grandmother, a father who had to see his child buried while he was still living, and how many lives are forever changed. With that impact statement being read, I'd like to now get into more of the notable facts of this case. I'd like to take you back to September 4th of 1993, that evening, transferring into the early morning hours of September 5th, 1993, that resulted in Bernadette's murder. That fateful evening, as you heard, Bernadette went out with her girlfriends for a girls' night after she came back in from being out of town. They were responsible and took a cab, as they knew they would be drinking. At some point, Bernadette's friends left without her, so Bernadette needed a ride home. And as you've heard, the inmate Cook's co-defendant, last name Plantage, offered her a ride home, and as Bernadette was open, friendly, and trusting, she accepted. Instead of taking her home, and I apologize, I'd like to note for the record that these facts all come from trial, the pre-sentence report, as well as the appellate record and the inmate's own statements. Instead of taking her home, Plantage drove her to a convenience store where they picked up inmate Cook and the juvenile. He was a 14-year-old boy, initialed as CM. They brought Bernadette back to Plantage's apartment, and it was there that inmate Cook and Plantage concocted a treacherous scheme to, quote, knock the victim out and gangbang her, end quote. CM testified at trial that he saw Bernadette on her hands and knees and Plantage on top of her, trying to rip off her dress and, quote, reach up into her vagina, end quote. At the same time, inmate Cook stood by Bernadette's head, and instead of helping her at this point, he actively participated in her assault by kicking her in the face at least 5 times. And as if this was not cruel enough, inmate Cook then took the assault a step further by taking a framing hammer and striking her in the head several times. Soon thereafter, inmate Cook and CM left the apartment. However, inmate Cook quickly turned the car around and drove back to the apartment, not because he wanted to help Bernadette, but because he left his cigarettes behind. When they pulled up, inmate Cook and CM saw that Plantage had Bernadette outside in the gravel area in front of the apartment, and Plantage was throwing rocks at her. Again, at this point, inmate Cook did not get out of his car and help Bernadette. Instead, he directed Plantage to slit her throat so that she could not tell anyone what they were doing to her. Additionally, he further solidified his intent to kill Bernadette by further telling Plantage that he had better hurry up and kill the woman before police came. Plantage went, obtained a knife from the apartment at inmate Cook's direction. He stabbed Bernadette, but in the course of the stabbing, the blade broke off. So he had to go back and get another knife. And again, instead of stopping the assault, inmate Cook stood there and watched Bernadette suffer in agony. Plantage then returned with a second knife, with which he slit Bernadette's throat, almost decapitating her, severing her spinal cord. All of this was done at the direction of inmate Cook. Police were called, inmate Cook confessed to murdering Bernadette and striking her in the head with a hammer. He also confessed to telling Plantage to slit Bernadette's throat because he did not want to go to jail. And I note that these are important because you heard him say today that he's not the one who made that command. That is contrary to what came out at trial under oath by 2 separate witnesses, CM, who was sitting inside of the car, and a neighbor who had their window open and who heard that directive come from somebody inside of the car. Both inmate Cook and Plantage went to trial. Both were found guilty of all counts, and CM testified against both of them. As you're aware, on November 28th, 1994, the Honorable Judge John Leonardo imposed his sentence of imprisonment for inmate Cook. First-degree murder, Class 1 felony, life without possibility of release until 25 years are served. The second count, kidnapping, Class 2 dangerous, for which he imposed the maximum amount possible of 21 years in the Arizona Department of Corrections, consecutive to the first-degree murder count. His third count, for which he was sentenced, was attempted sexual assault, a Class 3 dangerous felony, for which he received the maximum 15 years in the Arizona Department of Corrections, also consecutive to count 2. There are several notable points about the way that Judge Leonardo drafted the sentencing. First, it is clear that this judge found inmate Cook's actions to be one of the most vicious, senseless, and violent murders that he had encountered. We know this by the abundant number of aggravating factors he found in this case. As the board is aware, by case law, in order to find this aggravating factor, you only need to find one of heinous, cruel, or depraved. In this case, the judge found all 3 to be present. Examples of judges' findings include the following. For cruel, and these are statements taken directly out of the sentencing minute entry. Judge found that this offense was especially cruel because, quote, Bernadette Mori suffered great physical pain and endured severe mental anguish associated with the uncertainty of her timely fate during the course of events which took place on or about September 5th, 1993. He also found that Bernadette was alive and conscious during most, if not all, of the brutal assault upon her person, which began in Plantage's apartment and culminated into the slashing of her throat in the gravel area outside of the apartment. He determined that she was alive and conscious based on the following facts. It was undisputed that she was alive and conscious during the attempted sexual assault, during which time inmate Cook kicked her in the face and struck her with a hammer several times. Evidence established that she was alive and conscious in the gravel area in front of the apartment because a neighbor heard her groaning and crying at the time, which is consistent with the conclusion that she was suffering emotionally and physically. Also, Sam testified that she tried to get up while she was being assaulted. Bernadette suffered knife wounds consistent with defensive wounds to her hands, indicating that her consciousness and attempt to defend herself were present. It was also proven from the time that she was kidnapped, almost raped, severely beaten, and up to the time that the knife was plunged into her throat, that she was unfortunately alive and conscious. With regards to the heinous and depraved aggravators, the judge found that this was a particularly senseless killing. The inmate and Plantage could have sexually assaulted her without inflicting any of the physical injuries she was forced to endure, and certainly without killing her. Inmate Cook's intent to strike or beat her in order to render her unconscious for the purpose of sexually assaulting her demonstrates the utter senselessness of the murder. Evidence established that Bernadette was helpless to resist her two assailants almost from the start of the assault in the apartment, having been beaten with a hammer and kicked in the apartment by inmate Cook. Bernadette was utterly helpless to resist further assault by the time she lay in the gravel area. Once there, she had rocks hurled at her. She was unable to get up fully before she was stabbed with the first knife, and the second knife was used to fatally cut her throat. Clearly, she was helpless up until the time she was killed. And evidence clearly established beyond a reasonable doubt that Bernadette was killed at the direction of inmate Cook in order that she be eliminated as a witness. Inmate Cook directed Plantage that he slit her throat before the cops come, and that his intent to sexually assault her had ended long before the further infliction of torture and eventual fatal wounds. My second point, excuse me, despite the judge sparing inmate Cook from the death penalty, he imposed the maximum possible time allowed for kidnapping and attempted sexual assault. We know this because while the judge found that whatever mitigation was present was enough to spare inmate Cook's life at the time, it was not enough to spare him from super aggravated sentences on each count. In fact, the judge rejected at least 10 of inmate Cook's mitigating factors that he presented at trial and sentencing. In addition to the maximum term imposed of each count, the judge also imposed consecutive counts to each other. This is especially important because when a judge imposes consecutive counts, also known as stacking counts, it is a clear and unambiguous demonstration of the judge's intent to have the defendant serve the most amount of time possible, in this case equaling to the defendant serving practically the rest of his life in prison. These second points of maxing and stacking are very vastly important because they demonstrate that the judge already gave inmate Cook the most amount of mercy that the judge thought that inmate Cook deserved by sparing his life. And how do we know this? Because he could have given less than maximum or concurrent versus consecutive. We ask you to not mistake the judge's extension of mercy of not imposing the death penalty at the time as a reason to grant him a rollover or eventual parole. The leniency for life was given for one purpose, so not as to impose a death penalty. He does not get to use this act of leniency twice, first by escaping a death penalty, and second now as an opportunity to be free from incarceration. My fourth point is, we may have questions about why the judge imposed life without the possibility of release until 25 years versus life without parole. And there's a simple answer to that question. Life without parole was not an option at the time of sentencing. Like the truth in sentencing laws, life without parole, although enacted in 1994, only applied to offenses that occurred after January 1st of 1994. Inmate Cook participated in the murder of Bernadette in September of 1993, 4 months prior to that effective date. As this board is aware, truth in sentencing laws eliminated parole and many other early releases of inmates from prison and converted a more distinct set of mandated guidelines. The parole laws prior to January 1st, 94 were more liberal in that a person would be eligible for parole after serving 1/2 or 2/3 of the sentence. In this case, he can serve 2/3 of the sentence as the sentencing unit entry applies. And I will describe more about that in a moment. It is clear that although Judge Leonardo spared inmate Cook from the death penalty,
he imposed the next harshest penalty possible by doing his absolute most to ensure that inmate Cook spent the maximum amount of time possible behind bars. Another factor I'd like to bring to the board's attention is the consequence or the consequences of the laws that were in effect at the time of the sentencing. We've established that Judge Leonardo's intent was to ensure that inmate Cook spent the maximum amount of time, practically the rest of his life, incarcerated. And it is our position that we should honor that intent. It is also our position that if the board decides to release inmate Cook from his life sentence, allowing him to begin serving the sentences for his two other crimes, it would unjustly give him the undeserved opportunity to return to society. Given the laws in place at the time of sentencing, the sentencing structures allow for the kidnapping and the attempt sexual assault counts to be served at two-thirds time. That means, for the 21 years imposed for the kidnapping, he could serve 14. And for the 15 years imposed for the attempt sexual assault, he could serve 10. So conceivably, instead of serving the rest of his, likely the rest of his life in prison, as the judge intended, he could be out of 24 years. And although 24 years sounds like a long time, it is not a drop in the bucket. It pales in comparison to the death sentence he gave to Bernadette in 1993, and the life sentence of pain and suffering that he inflicted on her family members. We heard from inmate Cook about his version of events, the classes that he took, claiming he's taken all of the classes available as he was incarcerated. I would note for the board that there are other classes, as the board is well aware, cognitive restructuring, seeking other classes outside of what is appropriate, available in his private facility, and he's done none of that. And the board notably asked questions about that. So I understand that you also understand that. Something else that I would like to briefly bring up is we've heard the word, and somewhat of, if not an explanation, as an attempted excuse for inmate Cook's behavior of him abandoning Bernadette. Well, abandoning implies a step back and not an active participation. Inmate Cook actively participated in her murder. He took a hammer. He struck her several times. She did not die then, but she very well could have. And he came back and actively directed co-defendant, co-murderer, Plantage, to murder her. And the fact that he stated, or his position is, that he did not actively kill her has already been considered. It was considered when he was given life versus death. So we ask you to not apply that to this current situation as well. So I've spoken a lot about the details of the murder, the laws at the time that existed, sentencing. However, it is arguably most important today to focus and remember the destruction and the pain that both Bernadette and her family had suffered at the hands of inmate Cook. We must recognize the terror, the pain, and the inarticulable fear that she felt for hours on that horrific night. It wasn't enough that inmate Cook kidnapped her. It was not enough that he attempted to rape her. It was not enough that he exposed juvenile CM to the escalated level of criminal activity. It was not enough that he kicked her in the face several times while she was on her hands and knees, vulnerable, during the attempted rape. It was not enough that he claw-hammered her in the head with a hammer during the attempted rape. In addition to all these actions, he never once sought help for her. He never showed her any mercy. Instead, he decided to take these heinous, deplorable, and torturous actions a step further and direct his co-murderer to slit her throat. In spite of the state and the victim's family's call for death at the time of sentencing, the judge allowed for life. However, it is clear that the judge intended that inmate Cook's life was to be served until the end of his days in custody. And yet here we are, and because of inmate Cook's lack of accountability, yet again, Bernadette's loved ones are re-victimized and old wounds are torn open, fresh and raw. On that fateful morning of September 5th, 1993, Gary Morey lost his wife. A daughter lost her mother. We don't know what was going on inside of her head during this drawn-out, torturous night of terror, but we can safely assume that in the midst of her fear, in the midst of her crying, and in the midst of her calling out for help, that at the end her thoughts went to her daughter,
to her husband and to her family who she was leaving behind. What we know for certain, as you have heard today, is that the actions of inmate Cook resulting in Bernadette's death still torment Gary, his daughter, and their family. Do not compound that trauma by releasing inmate Cook from the life sentence that he so deservedly earned. Deny his request today. We are asking for a 1-year set off versus 6 months, and ensure that justice remains served. That is all I have, unless the board has questions for me.
No question, board members?
No.
Thank you so very much. So anyone else from the victim's side? Anyone else from the victim's side?
Not at this time.
Anyone else from the victim's side? Thank you. At this time, we will have, before the board goes in to discussion and makes its decision, the board will ask Mr. Cook and or his attorney to make a final statement, because this is Mr. Cook's hearing, and so I don't know which of you wish to speak or wish to speak first.
I'd be glad to speak first.
Okay, please come forward, sir. Once again, please state your name for the record, sir.
Thank you. David Lee Partito, attorney for Mr. Cook.
Thank you, sir.
Honorable members of the board, Mr. Chairman, no one, least of all my client, doubts the pain, the anguish, and the grief suffered then and now by the victim's family. That entirely, in fact, was the point of much of what I said, which was that Mr. Cook has learned empathy. He has learned to think about the victim as though he's thinking about himself and the people he loves. And that is the change he has made. What I hear counsel saying, however, is that the board should somehow go into the mind of Judge Leonardo 25 years ago, and try to suss out, ascertain what he intended. That's nothing more than an attempt to convert a 25-to-life sentence into a natural life sentence. And that's not what this board is here for. This board is to hear to determine whether under 412B, the parole serves the interests of the state. And the interests of the state include the interests of Mr. Cook, the interests of the victim, and the interests of the people of Arizona. And the focus should be, therefore, on whether Mr. Cook has benefited and reformed himself and done the penance, because that's where the word penitentiary comes from, necessary to merit parole after 25 years. We are not talking about, obviously, releasing Mr. Cook. Judge Leonardo imposed consecutive sentences. There may be a time to make that consideration because there is a petition for commutation, but this is not the time to consider it. This is the time to consider whether that first sentence has been served and whether he should have parole now that he is eligible after 25 years. But Mr. Cook has never admitted and does not admit now and did not plan this murder, concoct a scheme, encourage the murder, or control the actions of the actual killer, Mr. Plantage, Craig Plantage, in any way, shape, or form. He did what he did, and what he did was horrible enough. He acted, but he acted impulsively. He acted even now he cannot say why. Alcohol and drug and depression fueled disgust with the world. He hated himself, he hated the world, he turned it all outward. And when this man, this terrible man, Craig Plantage, literally placed a weapon in his hand and suggested this crime, he committed the crime. And for that, he has served 25 years and will likely serve many more years, no matter what this board does today. But punish him for what he did, and punish him for what he didn't do, which was, and I think counsel was right in pointing this out, as I pointed it out, he did not help the victim. He did not help Bernadette. And that, as much as anything, is what haunts him. It's one thing to say he was impulsive. And it's another thing to say, I knew I would help her. I thought about helping her, but I was afraid I couldn't do it. But don't punish him for something that he didn't do at all. He did not direct Mr. Plantage. He did not cry out for him to kill her. He did not ask if he cut her throat. That was all on him. And he has served an even longer sentence for that. He was the prime mover. This is not an excuse. This is simply putting justice where it belongs. A 25-year sentence with more to follow is not an inconsiderable sentence. So let's look at what Mr. Crook says and what he has done to try to do what he can to make amends. He can't take back what he's done. He wishes he could. He cannot. So what has he done instead? Here's what he told me, and I'm going to quote from the petition. In prison, I learned empathy. I was able to understand better what I had done by thinking about how I, too, had made poor choices. And no, it's not blaming the victim to say she made some poor choices that night, too. It is not blaming her one bit. She did not deserve, in any sense, what happened to her, or half of it, or a tenth of it, or a hundredth of it. But people make poor choices. He found himself in the wrong place, and he did some terrible things. She made some wrong choices, too. I was able to understand what the victim had lost, her life, her future, all of her possibilities, by realizing that the best years of my life, and perhaps my entire life, would be spent in a small cell and a drab day room. I am not comparing my fate to hers, but I am thinking about my punishment has given me the chance to understand better the enormity of what I had done and how much I had taken from her and her family. These were not thoughts and feelings I was capable of 25 years ago. The bottom line, members, honorable members of the board, is that this is not the man he was when he was 22 years old when he did these terrible crimes. That the man he is now must still be punished for those crimes, but he has changed his life. And he, as much as anyone, and I hope to give him a chance to speak in a minute, because the victim's representatives are here, he, as much as anyone, understands the enormity of what he has taken from them. But he has done everything he can, taking every class available to him, taking every program available to him, beaten his a very bad addiction, and done everything he can to try to restore himself to the decent person he once was. And I'd ask that you recognize that and take that into account, as well as taking into account the horrible loss suffered by the victim. Thank you.
Thank you so very much.
Oh, yes. Mr. Boucher. I'll keep it short. Perhaps it's just as one voting board member. I don't have holes in the story.
Sure.
What happened to Mr. Plantage?
You know, I what didn't come today compared to
This is not his hearing. Yes, I'm just saying this is very central.
Yes, it is very important, and I actually was going to ask for an opportunity to check on that the night of some of the things counsel said. It was my understanding that Mr. Plantage had received a natural life sentence. Now I don't quite know how to square that with what counsel said about the change in the law. My understanding is he was more severely punished. It's important also to point out, by the way, as you look at the record in this case, since you bring that up, that the juvenile did testify against both of the men at the trial. And the juvenile was involved in this crime to a somewhat lesser degree in some ways than the other two, but also participated in the sexual assault. And the juvenile, of course, being a juvenile, received a much less serious sentence. So there is a question of proportionality there that you raise. But my understanding is that Mr. Plantage either received a natural life sentence or was punished more severely in the term of years. And I'd be glad to check into that.
No, let me say again, as one voting board member, I mean, I'm going to look at the totality of this case, and that's that. But it just seems like we're discussing this, and I can't help but wonder, okay, what's the rest of the story then?
Right. Thank you. And I will reiterate that I think it's clear as you read this record that as horrible as my client's actions were, Mr. Plantage's were even worse, and that he was the instigator of this offense.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Mr. Cook, is there anything else you wish to say to the board without repeating yourself, sir, before the board goes into discussion and makes a final determination?
Thank you, sir. I would ask that the board consider me for parole. I think the state gave me what I deserve, and that was 25 years in prison. And I hope that you will give me the opportunity to show you that I am not the same kid that I was back then. Thank you, sir.
Thank you so much, Mr. Cook. At this time, the board is going into discussion. We're going to ask that you and everyone else will remain quiet. Although you cannot see us, Mr. Cook, please stay on the phone, because in Arizona, we do operate under the open meeting law, and everything we do is done in public. And this will be the first time that the board will have had the opportunity to discuss your hearing at this particular time. Before going into discussion and making this determination, I'm going to ask all members who are present, all persons present, please be professional. We know that this is emotional. We understand that. The board must be professional and will be professional in its carrying out its responsibility. So we're going to ask that everyone else would do the same. I'm also going to ask that when we depart after the board has made this determination, those who are supporting Mr. Cook, if they would exit from this side of the door of the room, and those who are supporting the victims from this side. And we can ask that no one show any emotions towards one another. Now the board is going into discussion. This is a very tragic crime that was committed. I think there's no question about it that Mr. Cook has admitted his involvement in this particular offense. This board has the responsibility of making a determination as one board member. I always like to consider the offense itself, the offender, in this case, Mr. Cook, also to consider the victim and the victim's supporters in making the determination. I want to be fair to all who come before this board. I think that as Hamlin had an opportunity to read all of the documents presented to this board, as well as testimony given to the board today, the question in my mind is, Mr. Cook ready to be paroled to his next sentence, which would be a 25-year sentence, a 21-year sentence for kidnapping? I've heard what Mr. Cook has said. To be sure, he's not the same person that he would have been back in 1993. But can I say that he's made enough progress up to this point? One area that I will point out is that, as he indicated himself, that he is at the first stage of the SOETP program. As one board member, I think it would be in his best interest, in the best interest of the state, for him to take more of that program. That's a very important program that the Department of Correction has instituted, and it truly makes a difference. I also think at this time that it would be in the best interest of the citizens of the state of Arizona that he not be paroled to his next sentence, or that he not be granted absolute discharge at this time. But that's only one person speaking. Now we yield to other board members. Mr. Galanis.
Thank you, Mr. Board Chairman. I'll begin by saying I want to dismiss any good that Mr. Cook has done to rehabilitate himself, redeem himself inside the correction system, and I hope he continues to have a positive effect or influence on his peers. My issue is not substance abuse, which is pervasive in this society, but the tremendous capacity for violence. I can't reconcile hitting an innocent in the head with a hammer as a prelude to rape, a crime in which the physical assault and the attempted rape in and of itself is enough to traumatize someone for the rest of their life. And I just, I can't see it serving the interest of justice nor public safety. Passing Mr. Cook to his next sentence at this point. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Neal, anything you wish to offer, sir?
I have a huge problem reconciling the amount of time the victim was mentally and physically suffering. Just a huge, intense amount of fear that she must have been going through at the time. And the idea that, which was, you know, two witnesses testified that Mr. Cook encouraged Mr. Plumage to kill her before the police showed up. At this point in time, in the interest of justice, I'm not in favor of the parole to next consecutive sentence.
Thank you, sir. Ms. Rittenhouse.
Thank you, Dr. Wright. We had some of the same thoughts that Mr. Quinones had, and I just keep questioning in my mind the idea of using a hammer on the head to knock somebody out. I mean, I can't imagine you'd use a hammer that would actually break the person's skull. I don't know what kind of judgment that took, but Mr. Cook indicated he was drinking, so his judgment was obviously impaired, but I just can't reconcile that, sir, and I agree, I don't think oral is appropriate at this time.
Thank you. Honorable Mr. Johnson.
That's right. I agree with my colleagues. I do want to commend Mr. Cook. I think he has taken quite a few programs. He's doing some programs while he's been incarcerated. He's been keeping a good prison record. I know that when this incident occurred, one of the things he said he needed some help. He was depressed with anger that he's in there. I just think that I would hope that Mr. Cook would continue to stay on the right track and work his way out of it. I just do have a hard time just at this point in time hearing that he's at that point where he no longer needs the help and the programming that he's receiving inside the institution. I think all that helpful to him to reach that point.
Thank you, sir. Any further discussion by board members? Hearing none, I should offer a motion at this time. My motion is to for Mr. David M. Cook, DOC number 109489, is to deny parole to his next consecutive sentence, as well as to deny absolute discharge, and that is my motion.
I'll second.
Agreed. Seconded by Honorable Ms. Rittenhouse. Agreed by the Honorable Mr. Kawanis, the Honorable Mr. Neal, the Honorable Mr. Johnson. I follow, is there any objection to a 1-year set off?
No.
Hearing none, that would be a 1-year set off. And this hearing today is a 412B, 411. Reasons for denial, and I will state some, and board members encourage you to add any others. Serious and violent offense. loss of human life, serious and deviant offense, trauma to the victim. I'm also going to add the age of the victim, with the use of a hammer, serious bodily injury. I am also going to include, well, we don't need a release man at this time, it's too early for that. He does have family support. He's had appropriate demeanor. Come to the board, I would like to see him to continue with some programming. I know that because he's been there, he's had a number of programs, but until recently, until 2017, I believe it was, there have not been any in recent time. Well, we do commend him for his lack of disciplines that he's had recently. Board members, is there anything else that this board wishes to include at this time? Yes, ma'am.
Could we consider victim harassment, please, because of the extended time over which the crime occurred?
Okay, victim harassment.
That's up at the top.
Yes, ma'am. Anything else any other board member wish to include? If not, Mr. Cook, you heard the determination of this board. The board has voted to deny your parole to your next consecutive sentence or absolute discharge. We have stated the reasons, and I ask, do I need to repeat the reasons at this time, sir? Mr. Cook?
Yes, sir.
Do I need to repeat the reasons for the denial at this time, sir?
For the
action that's been taken by this board, do I need to repeat anything, sir?
Yes, no, sir.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, we will receive a written decision, I presume.
Yes, sir, you will receive one.
I'll share that.
Yes, sir.
Well, yes.
And Mr. Cook, you will be certified by the Department of Corrections to appear before this board again in about a year from then. May not be on this exact date, but once you've been certified, then the Board of Executive Clemency will place you on the calendar, and you will be eligible to participate again at that time. This will end the hearing. Thank you so very much for participating. Thanks all for being so professional. One group, the victims, I'm sorry, the supporters, this to the north side, the victims to the south side as we exit. Thank you, and the hearing is over. Thank you.